I'm just gonna put this over here.
Sure.
My little recording studio.
Dope. Millennial recorder. Yeah.
So I guess let's start by, could you introduce yourself?
Okay. My name is Vanessa Zeki. I am from Lesotho originally. Mm. I grew up in Lesotho, Canada, and England. And I came
Canada and England.
Canada and England.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's like two polarities.
Yeah, yeah. I was due to my parents' academics, so they're doctors, and they were studying. So part of their scholarships luckily allowed them to come with their families. Mm. So we're very much an academic. We're almost like army kids, but in an academic sense, because we were jumping from one university. All my life, we've been just living at different universities. So I grew up in a university sort of atmosphere.
Okay.
And then I came to South Africa for the first time in 2008 to be at ECT.
Okay. What were you studying there?
I was studying politics and drama.
Jeez, I'm just seeing all these different things.
The polar.
Politics. Academics and now yoga, right?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So I studied politics and drama mainly because when I first decided, I applied to all the major schools in South Africa, Wits, Rhodes, whatever, and I really was gung-ho on being a lawyer because, you know, in so limited at that time when people tell, you know, if you're not good in maths and science, then, and you're good at English and history and stuff, then you're a lawyer. Like, so that's the next best thing.
Because you can talk your way out of situations.
Because you can talk your way stuff, you can debate. So I thought it was perfect. I loved watching Ally McBeal and The Practice. So I was like, yeah, that's the life I want to live. The yoga journey for me is really about a place where I can completely, like, connect with myself and find silence and stillness and ability to... Not, you know, you're not a yoga teacher when you're doing yoga, you're not a meditator, you're not Banista, you know nothing, you are actually just, you kind of connect to just a sentient being. In Kundalini yoga, before we teach a class, we have to do, we tune in, and this is before the students arrive, then we have to repeat the teacher's oath, and that is, I'm not a man, I'm not a woman, I'm not a person, I'm not myself, I am a teacher. And you say that three times because that's really about removing the ego. And I think that's the beautiful thing in terms of those pockets you talk about, I interpret that as being pockets where you're not sort of dictated by the ego and its need to identify with things. Mm. So you're reading, I mean, it does come up in yoga practices, obviously, yoga practices where you kind of feel like, why am I not doing this? Or am I slow or something? But really, when you're genuinely connected to your practice, you just sort of flow into it. And that's something that I find myself in those pockets, definitely. Mm.
It's interesting that you speak about ego. Because, I mean, as a principal, a business environment can be driven by ego, for instance.
Yeah.
And here you are teaching yoga, but you're also... using yoga as a career, in a sense.
Yeah.
So you almost have to, you know, if I can find the right word, reconcile the two.
Yeah.
The business side as well as the more fluid side.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I mean, myself and Anisu don't really see this as a business because we have other jobs, you know?
Mm.
So this isn't mainstream of income. We don't see it in that way. This, for us, feels like a saver. And maybe when we start making lots of money, it'll start to feel like a job. But right now, it feels like selfless service. We are creating a space for people that is inclusive, that really recognizes, yoga space that recognizes the sort of dynamic of the country and realizes that there are places that you don't feel very comfortable doing this really sacred, beautiful practice. And we've created that space in that sense. And the business part is, you know... It wasn't even in, like, the way it even came about wasn't like a planned thing, like, then I'm going to do this and this and this, and we had a business plan, and then we got into it. Mm. Really just flowed into my life, and same with her. And it just, every month, like, you know, we're still at a point where there's still overheads we need to cover, and I don't know where we get the money from. It just, when the time comes, it's like, oh, will you look at that? We're able to go through another month. So it's literally taking it month by month, and I feel we've both spoken about this in depth, that I'm being pulled and pushed by something that is beyond us, and it really falls within alignment. I don't feel like I'm trying too hard with this. Yes, on my mind sometimes I'm like, oh, I still have this bill to pay, but it always just seems to effortlessly come to play. So
mm.
yeah, I don't think I've yet reconciled it as a business, and also I don't identify with it. So as much as we got a lot of attention for doing the studio, if it shuts down tomorrow, it shuts down tomorrow. Like I haven't attached myself to its success and I haven't attached itself to its demise.
Mm.
It's sort of its own little entity that just needs people to, I'm a little assistant in allowing the space to be for people.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you speak about the space almost existing as a service.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, you mentioned something about the dynamic of the country. Do you want to get into that?
Yeah, so, you know, I feel like, so I got trained by an NGO called Kundalini Africa Rising that is founded by a woman called Rabika Itereso. Mm. And she had been teaching Kundalini for years and years, and she's like high up in there, you know, powerful teacher. And at some point she was teaching to a class and she looked up after so many years of teaching this powerful technology, especially Kundalini, because Kundalini really is about harnessing your potential and power.
I love that you refer to it as technology.
Yeah. That's what we're taught it is. Yeah. So it's really about harnessing your power in order to just be exponential in this lifetime. So she's teaching this and she's looking up and still seeing a class full of middle-aged white women. And she's like, in South Africa, like this is not okay. So she spent a lot of her energy trying to speak to the powers that be at the time to, you know, can we get more teachers of color, you know, because there's so much going on in the country
mm.
that if there was just a semblance of this yoga or this technology, as I'm saying, being utilized by people, it would really create a shift, you know?
Yes.
And right now it's inaccessible because to get a teacher training, it's like 50,000 rand or plus in Kundalini yoga. To go to a Kundalini yoga class in these places are pretty expensive, and where they're situated, as in this one, is in suburban areas. You know, you don't find them in the townships and the rural areas. So it's really inaccessible on so many levels.
Mm.
So after pushing and pulling and getting no response for her cries falling on deaf ears, she decided to break away from those powers and start her own organization. And she's just been working, self-funding, and training many black teachers. And I'm a product of that initiative.
Okay, you're part of the X-Men.
Yeah, basically. And so we're out there, and it is true, she was right, because what happened is she trained black teachers and they created a studio like this. That is an inclusive studio, because there's a sentiment around a lot of black yogis that I've spoken to are yogis of color, and is that if you want to feel what it's like to be a black person, go to a yoga studio,
because
then your blackness is going to be highlighted. You know, we don't feel black when you're in, I don't feel black when I'm sitting here, so that's not something to feel. You know, you're only told you're black once you're in the contrast, which is in a white space, and you know, you're usually going to be the minority. And, you know, especially even as yogis who have been doing this for a year, even still when I go to yoga studios like that, I feel like I've got so much to prove. Because, you know, people are like, oh, shame, is she trying this for the first time? Or, you know, you're like, damn it, I'm a teacher. Like, and so you're going a little, your ego kind of comes to play and affects my practice, because you've got, there's so much politics around the dynamic of you just being in that space.
Mm.
And so we wanted to create a space that everyone felt comfortable in, black, white, colored, Indian, Asian, whatever, gay, transgender, straight, male, female, all of these stereotypes that have said that yoga isn't for you, it isn't for boys,
yes.
It isn't for men, it isn't for black people, it isn't for transgender people, you know, because as a transgender person, you want to come in dressed the way you want to come in, and you don't want to be made a mockery, you know. So these are the kind of issues that we're trying, and we're not saying we're 100% there and we're the best, but we are opening up that dialogue, opening up the space, and ready to learn. So yeah, that's what the Nest really is about.
It's peculiar, because, you know, when you are doing yoga, when you're engaged in the practice of doing yoga, as I was a couple of minutes ago, sweating it out, you know, it almost feels like there's no form, and by extension, no body, no color, right? But, you know, when you speak about the dynamic of the country, for instance, you mentioned that when you are in the contrast, you then become the color.
Yeah.
But actually, that doesn't exist in the practice.
There's no such thing as black. There's no such thing as white. There's no such thing, especially as such polarities.
Mm.
You know, what about the people in between? we all know, we've seen them, the people who you're quite not sure, are you black, are you white, are you mixed, like, what about, like, there is no such thing, it's all a social construct that has been applied onto us. A child doesn't know what black or white is, you know, you can have a black parent and a white parent, they don't see the difference till they're told there's a difference, and that's really the state of our sort of life education, and it's problematic.
I want to go back to something that you presented earlier, which is, you know, exponentiality. My understanding of exponentiality is growth with no bounds, right? And that can happen in any form. It can happen in a, you know, physical form. It can happen in a spiritual form. It can happen in an economic form. It can happen in any way.
Definitely.
I guess what I'm trying to get to is the practice of yoga is essentially to create a space where form is no longer an inhibitor, essentially, right? It's no longer a constraint. And bringing that type of understanding, do you feel like yoga needs to be expanded to more spaces, more spaces where people feel like they're more constrained, whether they're constrained by education, constrained by whatever the situation is that part of your vision as well, as a yoga teacher?
That's the vision, that's the ethos, that's the school of thought I come from. We were trained in diversity. You know, we were trained in community-based yoga. So we weren't trained to actually come really be do yoga as a career, though you can, but it was really about giving it as a save and helping build communities with it. You know, a lot of, in modern day, people use yoga to de-stress, you know, relax and like connect with the self, you know, and these are people working high powered jobs, maybe, you know, a teacher at a school or an account executive or accountant, and you know, this is a place where I can just relax. That for me, I mean, compared to the person who doesn't know where their next meal is coming from, or the person who's dealing with violence in the home, or the person who's dealing with stigma, yoga, I mean, if it works, it I think they're the people who need it the most. Not that there's any comparison, everyone needs yoga, you know. Your problems, let's not make a competition of whose problems are bigger than the other.
Sure.
But I do think there are spaces where it can really, really shift not just a personal and individual sort of understanding, but a whole sort of paradigm and community. If I'm lacking something, the mind and the body reacts in that way. But if I am working from a point of abundance and choice and control and power, the body reacts in that way as well.
Yeah, that's actually interesting, because I mean, this is a very basic example of something that happened recently, you know, where I woke up feeling quite shitty. And, you know, for about, let's say about an hour, I was still sort of practicing this emotion of feeling bad, right? And then I was like, I thought to myself, it was a Saturday, I was by myself at the house. And I thought, you know what, why am I feeling this way? Am I choosing to feel this way? Can I choose something else? Is it possible? Is it even possible? So I decided, okay, let me just go to the bathroom and look at myself in the mirror and spend a little bit of time just looking, right? And eventually I was like, okay, let me try and practice some joy.
Yeah.
Right? And then initially, you know, it was like, okay, it felt a bit strange. But after a couple of minutes, I was literally like laughing out loud in the bathroom by myself, right?
Yeah.
And it felt great because all of a sudden I shifted from this very morbid feeling to exhilaration.
Yeah.
And from there, my day was amazing because I decided to do all these things.
Yeah.
Just from a choice. And I started to question. I was like, well, if I can choose these two different feelings, what else can I choose?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Right?
Yeah. I'm learning that the book that I sort of attribute to my awakening is Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth.
Yes.
And in that book, I read that about 9 or 10 years ago. He basically speaks of that there's no such thing as bad or good. There just is in your perception of it, you know? And it's taken years to be able to really integrate that belief system into me. But yeah, I'm currently doing a 90-day meditation practice. And there are times when I'm sitting there and I'm meditating and I'm like, oh, you know, my mind is going wild. I'm like, this is a shitty meditation. But then immediately I'm like, or is this just a meditation that might not perceive, why is it shitty? Because my mind is, why don't you just accept it as it is and see where this is going to take you? And then when I do that, that completely shifts that. Same as with my day, you know, you start, the same as you were saying, you start off being like, oh, everything's going wrong, I forgot my phone, I forgot this, like, I forgot, or is this an opportunity? You know what it really is about the mind? And once the mind is the most powerful thing, it's almost been said to a cliche where it almost doesn't have an effect. The same as people talk about self-love and how amazing that is. Like, oh, self-love, self-love, powerful mind. No, no. Like, in actual fact, when you're able to harness and understand the power of the mind, you are unstoppable. That literally takes you out of the matrix. That's your key out of this whole delusion. And so, yeah, I think once you start practicing that control, realizing that, actually, I can create my own destiny. And as simple as that, today I was meditating, and the meditation the teacher that I was teaching this morning, I had her keys. And the thing is, I'm doing my practice, so about four different series that I do, and you know, I did the first one, I was like, she said she's gonna be here up at 7, but I don't wanna be disrupted. So I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna do this section, and as soon as I'm done, then she should come in. She mustn't come before then. This is what I've told my mind. Go through the first breathing practice, I'm done. She hasn't come. I'm like, okay, I'm getting up, I'm going downstairs, and push comes to shove, I'm gonna leave the keys at the restaurant so I can start my second one, which is my next meditation, which is an hour, and I don't want to be disturbed. Go downstairs in my pajamas, open, and there she is on the phone, on the card. I'm like, did you try to call me? She's like, no, I was trying to get airtime. And I was like, oh, well, here you go, here are the keys. I honestly believe I made that happen just through my mind of saying, this is what I want, this is how it's gonna happen, and this is how it's going down. And so many other examples. And I'm sure there's not a human alive who cannot say, who cannot resonate on some level where they're like, whoa, did I do that? You know what I mean? But this world is geared to tell you that, no, you can't do that. You need to rely on everything external.
You know, playing with the idea of gratitude versus appreciation. You know, where gratitude becomes more of a, oh, this thing has come to me, so I must be thankful for it. Whereas appreciation is more like you were an active participant in actually creating this thing that has come to you. And therefore, by appreciating it, then it, you know, it becomes exponential, right? It grows. The reason why I bring that up is I'm going back to this idea of choice, right? Where the health of our choices or the unhealthiness of our choices can create certain things in our lives that can either be disruptive or exponential.
Right?
And really, this is an interesting idea to me because of, again, the country that we're in. We're speaking about the dynamic of the country and how we see ourselves and how we see others, right? That we almost, you know, I was sitting at the park yesterday before coming here. When I got your message, I was actually driving. Then I was like, oh, actually, let me just go to the park and just walk around, sit, whatever, do whatever, right? I got to the park and I started walking around, and then I found a bench, sat at the bench, and I was looking at the rose bushes at Amarantia Park. And obviously, you know, it's the beginning of winter, the leaves have fallen. And normally, you know, that place is very beautiful. It's, you know, roses everywhere. It's gorgeous, right? But now there's leaves on the ground, you know, everything has withered, it's dry, right? And I was sitting there thinking, this is interesting because it's almost like there's a, you know, there's a seasonality to not just plants and flowers, but our own lives as well, as humans, right? And we get to dip in and out of that seasonality. And I was wondering, because we are an extension of nature, we're not just part of it, we're an extension of it. What are those seasons? You know, what are the leaves that drop? Is it our mental state? Is it, you know, perhaps an unhealthy body? Is it, you know? And when it flowers again, what is that?
Yeah. Right?
But we're active participants in
that. Definitely. 100%. And I think for me, mine is more attuned to seasons, actually. So when it gets quite cold, I become quite, I act like a normal classic animal. I hibernate, you know, I go inside, I look at the types of food, my diet changes, and also I become a lot more contemplative and reflective. And this is this point, you could, it can go either way. You can either go quite, get quite depressed because you're just really reflecting and being like, I'm not where I want to be, and all of that. Or you can really be like, quite like, okay, this is what I'm going to do, you know, dreaming and all of that in imagination. And then as it becomes warmer, I start to step out, you know, just like the flowers. Now I want to step out. I'm more willing to engage and be social and, you know, see things, spend more time outside and everything. So, and I mean, I've got more ideas and I want to execute stuff. And I think that's really what I want to be in line with. Also, like, as a woman, you know, I'm almost there where I'm able to coordinate my moon cycle with the cycle of the moon. So and that's real power. That's when you're aligned with nature as a woman, is when the full moon comes and you start your periods. That's really, because it's really about releasing and new beginnings and all of that. And a lot of my yogi friends are on it. And you know, the ways to do it, you can stare at, people have said if you're able to stare at the moon for a couple of minutes, like 20 minutes, that it has some effect on it. If you put an intention, which I did, put an intention of going towards the cycle of the moon, that also seems to happen. And it's crazy, like, no one documents, and we live in a world where if it's not said or written or told, it doesn't exist. But you know, how do you explain my moon cycle just being like that? Or even women together, like the women who are close to my life, our ability to all latch onto each other and be on the same cycle just shows, you know, the beautiful subtle currents of nature that happen that we try to ignore. Like, man's whole thing is about being as far away from nature as possible, you know, building way tall buildings and polluting it and doing all that. And that's really, it's man's karma, because it'll destroy us.
But for some reason, when the full moon is out, I feel more creative.
Yeah.
I suppose maybe it's could be projected, or I don't know, whatever it is. I just feel
that's also a thing we're taught to doubt ourselves when we can't explain it with facts and evidence.
So I was actually about to say that, because, you know, there's experience and then there's the intellectual way of thinking, right? Whereas experience will give you so much that you sometimes you can't explain.
Yeah.
But it's there.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And that's what connection, what human beings love. The people that I feel like, when I say I've had a connection with, is where we're able to understand each other without having to explain or prove or show anything, where we just get, you get it, you know? And that's what a real authentic connection derives from. Connection with nature, where you don't have, the tree doesn't need to explain, like my plants, a lot of the time I've got a lot of plants in my house and here at the studio, it's just sometimes getting what they need, you know? Like, you know, I know what it is today, but I feel like it needs a bit more water today. Or no, it's I feel like it's that's just, I get you. Because we're now connecting on the rhythm, because we're all one. And that's the whole thing about the ego in a world that is that services our egos, is to make us think that we're other. I'm different from you. You're male and I'm female. You're this and I'm that. And that creates separation, which sort of takes away our superpower. But when I start to have an understanding that you and I are one and the same, like really, not just as in like the old Rainbow Nation bullshit, like we're one and the same, you start to really tap into a power that's just like, wow, if you're me, then there's a lot I can do. Ego is what I believe to be the main proponent of not seeing us connected. You know, as a child, you're born pure, as we call it. Just looking at the world, and you can just see by the eyes that there's no judgment. Even as I look, you're judging me and I'm judging you. I don't think you're negatively judging me, but there's still a judgment, because that's just our process. You're listening to what I'm saying. You're listening. Does it resonate? Does it not? You know, a child just looks, and you can see in their eyes that there is no judgment. It's just information. The pupil is dilating. It's just taking it in, whether right or wrong. You know, and then as time goes forward, we start to, society, parents, whatever, we start to enforce this understanding where the kid starts to, as they learn mine, yours. So my toy, your toy, my school, my mom, my dad, I. That is all ego. That is all ego. And Eckhart Tolle illustrates that way better than I ever could in The New Earth and The Power of Now. But mainly New Earth about the ego. And it's this separation of I, then suddenly pulls me away. And then
there's a line all of a sudden.
There's a line all of a
sudden. Because this is I.
And it's a subject mine. That I can concentrate on. You know, because everything else, the ego is limited. it can't comprehend the idea of us being one, because that's too much to comprehend.
Mm.
There's limitations. It's going to break. It's going to break. It'll burst, because it's like, this is how can all be one? That's not something that's not, it's not in its nature to understand it. Mm. But its nature is to dissect and pull apart.
So, and put everything into boxes.
To the smallest, most minuscule thing. The smaller, the better. Mm. And that's how we make ourselves small.
Mm.
Is by dissecting and creating the separation from everything. Even we have separation within ourselves, you know, this duality. Oh, I am this and I am that. Oh, I'm a yogi, but I'm also, you know, a music promoter, but I'm also a mother, but I'm also all these other things, these things that people, these roles that cause you to split yourself within you. Why can't you just be everything?
Mm.
You know, in one, and that really becomes a problem. And now we live in a society that pinpointed that we have the seed. The ego, I think, as man came, was just a seed. And then you feed, when you feed a seed and you nurture a seed, it becomes a freaking giant tree.
Mm.
And that's the world we live in right now, is the ego has taken over us. You know, and that's where we see the dysfunction in this world. That's why we have wars. That's why we have rape. That's why we have, you cannot rape someone unless you see that person as separate. You cannot steal or beat or hurt someone unless you see that person is completely separate from you.
If you because see them, you're hurting yourself, essentially.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. Yeah. And so there's that level.
And in fact, interestingly enough, is that nature will show you. You know, it'll almost punish you instantly.
100%,
100%. when you're causing 100%. Harm to another person.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's exactly
when road rage happens, for instance. As soon as you get into that mental frame, that in itself is nature's way of punishing you.
And that's what I was trying to tell my brother yesterday. My brother has the worst road rage known to man, and he gets so like, and I'm just like, whoa, dude, we're just having a lovely conversation. Like, who is that guy? You don't even know him. Like, you are suffering 10 times. He's sped off. He's gone.
And you're still here. Forgotten.
And he's probably forgotten. Oh, he's in the same situation as you, just as angry. And you're stewing.
And you're both being punished.
Exactly. That's the thing with anger as well. That's what I learned is, like, through the meditations of Vipassana and Eckhart Tolle's teaching and, you know, Kundalini Yoga, is really realizing a lot of the times when I'm here to protect myself. As selfish as that may sound, it really isn't. Because I say, I'm not going to allow this to disturb my peace.
Mm.
And that's where it boils down to. So when something happens, I'm like, no, not today.
Mm.
You know, today, I'm going to let this go because I don't want to sit with this.
Yes.
The inability to forgive is an older days, you know, it's like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die.
Mm.
You not being able to forgive is a sin. And you're punished immediately because you're just by the emotions that you hold on to that, you know, and all that tension and all that toxicity that it requires to keep that non-forgiving nature.
And it sits in your body. It spreads.
In your body.
It can become cancerous at some point.
It is cancer. Mm. It is cancer. It is irritable bowel syndrome.
Mm.
It is chronic migraines. It is weird skin conditions. It is all of that. All manifests from thought.
Mm.
And that is all ego is. It is thought.
Mm.
Yeah.
I like how you phrased it in the beginning. You were talking about how, you know, the boxes that ego creates essentially make you into a smaller version of yourself.
Mm.
Because you're not boundless anymore.
Exactly.
You're constricted, right? You've got all these boundaries around you.
Yeah.
And you put yourself in that boundary.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're a prisoner, essentially.
you create your own prison in that sense. And that's why, if you look at society and you look at the people who have been deemed crazy, who have been deemed undesirables, who have been deemed threats, really, really start to break it down and start to, these people were just freer than we are. Because also, the ego that we were just talking about is one on a micro level within. But this is multiplied and sort of rippled into a macro level. So this box is created by society, by powers that be. Say, no, you are a girl, and this is
therefore
your box.
This is how you must behave.
And you are a boy.
Mm.
This is, and if you step out of that line, if you're a boy and you start wearing a dress, whoa, who is coming down on you? You know what I mean? And that's the crazy thing is that I was having this conversation with another friend of mine, we're at the Rusty Vegan, is talking about the people who the custodians of this belief system. It is not, you know, during Nazi times, Hitler and his Goebbels or whatever they're called did not have the capability to enforce that form of propaganda and dictatorship regime on every individual the way they did. They couldn't personally be knocking on everyone's door, checking and seeing, do you have this? Are you doing this? No.
Mm.
They needed to have... That's why propaganda is so freaking powerful. And we go back to the mind, which I think is going to be the main theme of this whole talk, is the mind.
Mm.
That is where they got people. Because then you start, you first brainwash people into thinking that this is how it should be. So that when you step out of the line, the people who you should be scared of during that Nazi day wasn't Hitler.
It's actually your neighbor.
It's your neighbor.
Yeah.
It's your brother. It's your mother.
Yeah.
Because they think it's in your best interest to fall within this line, because if Nazi people find out, you're going to be in trouble. So they enforce it.
Yes.
So it's the same with my mom, you know, going vegan. Saving the planet, climate change, animal rights, the host of benefits and reasons I'm doing this are endless. The person who comes down on me the most is my mom.
Yeah, because she's attached to a particular belief system. Yes,
exactly,
right, that says
exactly.
You are possibly, maybe you're black and you're this and you're that.
Exactly.
Therefore, you cannot be.
Exactly. That. There's this Vice documentary that I was watching, and this is incredible. And it talks about the third industrial revolution.
Mm.
And he makes an example, the economist there, who blows my mind, really. He speaks of why millennials are the only hope for this world, right? If you look at the difference between our parents and their parents and us and our children, our parents grew up in a very egocentric way.
Mm.
Yeah, conscious and unconscious. It was like, okay, I need to get my education so I can get my wife,
mm-hmm.
my husband, my family, my kids. And I want
to
own...
And present a specific image to the
create
world.
Create a specific image, have my own house, my own car, you know, my own retirement plan, and good. And, you know, neighbors will be polite, will be good, will be friendly, but, you know, good luck in this rat race of life, you know.
Mm.
They were about ownership, which comes down to ego. Mine.
Mm.
The spanner in the works was when the millennial generation said, that's not working, I don't want to own something. How about we share it?
Mm.
And it came through in technological advances. So
Airbnb, for
there
instance.
We go. Why must I own a mansion when I can we can share your house?
Yeah.
Own a car, or we can share
a
car.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it comes to, there's also this thing where this in technology that he spoke about, I mean, example where toys. It must start from that point where you don't say to your kid must understand there's this app where you share toys. So then when the kid gets it, they have an understanding that this came from someone else. I have it for a certain amount of time.
Let me make use of it.
I have to make use of it and take care of it. Yeah. And in order for the next kid who's coming to be able to.
Yes.
So our parents didn't have that. So that's why our oceans are full of plastic. That's why the climate change is at a tipping point at this very moment, is because they believed, my mind, I'm good as... But they didn't understand, they never thought of, well, the next generation.
Mm.
There's no, they didn't see value in that. And millennials are the ones who have stopped that chain, thanks to the internet and information. If you can't lie to me, I don't care if America keeps denying climate change is happening. You know, the internet has shown that actually, it's coming
day,
from
a
political standpoint, because we can feel it, we can see it, we can, everything. Like, the oceans are full of plastic.
Mm.
The fish that you're eating, dear pescatarians, is full of plastic. The millennials are understanding that we're their last hope.
Mm.
We need to clean up the oceans. We need to start creating industries and a way of life that supports sustainability.
So that's, you know, that just brings about, you know, we're talking about business earlier on and reconciling business with spirituality.
Definitely.
And yoga and your practice. Mm. That these things are actually not separate at all. Like, you know, the idea of, you know, going back to the example that you made about Uber and the toy story, is there's an integration of humanity within the business itself, right?
Yeah.
This idea of sharing, it's a very human thing.
Yeah.
And yet, here's Airbnb making money out of it.
Yeah,
And for me, that's beautiful, because you're now integrating rather than separating.
Definitely.
Therefore, taking away the ego and
Definitely.
The lines that we've drawn in the sand. Would you say that that's the business of the future, this idea of integrating?
Oh, 100%. So I'm doing my honors at Vega, and I'm doing my honors in strategic brand building and communications. and we're all about fourth industrial brands, third industrial brands. If you are not an ethical, responsible, conscious brand, you're not going to make it. Because that's another thing. This is why millennials will hit you on all levels. We have buying power. Mm. We are the people who are buying right now. And if you look at people like everything, for right now, I'm so thirsty. And because I left my water bottle at home. I am not going to go down to the shop downstairs and buy water because it comes in a plastic bottle. No. Unless it's in a glass bottle, I'm going to wait. Luckily, my home is just up there. I'm going to go and I'm going to go get my water that I get from Oasis that is in a tub that I refill and I pour my water and I drink. This is how millennials think to a different extent.
Mm.
They say, where does this come from?
Mm.
When you say this is organic, or this is grass-fed. Like, they want to know, oh, it's black-owned. Oh, it's millennials aren't just about the product. They're about where it comes from. And a brand is a story. Mm. What is your story telling me? This is why I will choose Apple over Nokia. Because look at what Steve Jobs, they talked about thinking differently. They were about innovation. They were about changing the world. We can all say those things. This is why if you don't have this sort of ethos as a brand, and as a business, you're literally not going to make it. For me, the difference between, something is mundane. Oh, I need to buy paper for the printing machine. There's this paper that costs 50 Rand, you know, normal paper, tree, blah, blah. But hey, you can pay 70 Rand, but this is recycled paper from, or elephant dung paper, or whatever that's used to this. And a portion of the proceeds go to ABC and D. 20 Rand difference, I'm willing to pay 20 Rand difference. That is the value of it.
Mm.
And I will pay extra for that.
Because the value doesn't actually sit in the paper itself. Exactly. It sits in what it's doing
exactly.
to the environment.
Exactly, exactly. And that's also with me as an entrepreneur. Like, my whole, I've got a holdings company that is Be Creative Holdings, Be Creative Group. And our ethos is do what you love and find a way to get paid for it. Right?
Mm.
And under there, I have businesses. I've got Organic Nomad, which is my yoga and wellness, which is about bringing yoga and wellness to communities, especially of color, but not just exclusive to it.
Mm.
And really teaching people and encouraging people and guiding people on a spiritual and a health path to make them be the best that they can in that aspect.
Mm.
There is the Nest Space, which is a yoga studio, which is a physical premise.
This is where we're currently at.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is where we're probably beautiful at. Studio, by the way.
Thank you. Where it's a premise where people can feel inclusive and safe and do yoga. We also have events. There's a Lala, Miss Lala, she's an influencer, is doing a body self-image talk here on the 4th of May.
Okay.
We have Wandile Mbalenia, musician, doing a acoustic set here, an intimate acoustic set coming up.
I'll be sure to check those
yeah,
out.
Yeah, and we'll let you know about all those stuff. So this is really a space for people to physically come of shared mindset, you know.
Mm.
I've got Be Creative, which is not Be Creative Holdings, Be Creative, which is what we call in branding the flanker brand. So it's the main brand.
Mm.
And this is where I do consultancy for branding, communications, PR. I do events, you know, that sort of aspect of it. There's Urza Lee, which is just launching right now, and it's we do incense, essential oils, candles, tea.
Okay.
So it's really at all.
Are those sourced externally, or do you have so people making those?
We have people making them,
okay.
But also again, as a millennial business owner, took me so long to find a supplier for the essential oil because I want to know, where is it coming from? Mm. Where are the farmers? Are they fair trade? Are they getting? Are these farmers who are being ripped off? And now my company, I don't want to be associated. So it really is about the value chain. That's what we are. And all my companies have a value chain. We want to follow it down. If there is a chink in the chain, let me know. Because then I can rectify it. Because I'm doing everything I can to make sure that we are sustainable, ethical, and we're for the betterment of all human beings.
So let me ask you something. Is there still some kind of ignorance, particularly in the yoga community, when it comes to diversity?
So I mean, we have that issue in our Sangha, which is our yoga community and community yoga in South Africa. And it's just we are at a sort of standstill right now because we have white yogis and yogis of color. And we can still see by virtue of some of the things that they say, there's still a level of ignorance around diversity and about rights and about things that are okay to be said. And okay, among racial things and also in the LGBT community, as yogis will be saying, and ladies, da 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 da. how about we don't use those labels, you know, how we don't know if everyone identifies white or as color, ladies. This type yeah, you know what I mean? Those black, are, there's an education process that needs to happen, but I remember in our Sangha, there was, you know, we have this thing, because ours is really community-based, so it's really about really tackling these issues on. And this idea of, on the one hand, yes, we want to create spaces where we can have open dialogue and discuss things, where white people should be free enough to say stuff and be able to not be like, you know, attacked for it, and they can and build, and then you start to educate, and it's like, whoa.
So you become educated rather than
attacked.
Yeah.
So then they're like, whoa, I never saw it like that. So there's that one school of thought that believes, you know, let's create spaces where people can say the most radical things, where in when whichever, whether it be in the gay community, LGBTQ community, or the black community, white community, let's just have spaces, because else, how are we going to heal?
Because you don't get educated if you're quiet about something.
There we go, right?
Just doesn't happen.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, what happens is that you keep it in and
it manifests into something bigger. Yeah. Then you have another school of thought that's like, I hear you, but white person, you've had more access to resources to gather the information of how the slavery came into being. You have been given better schools. You've got money for the internet. You've got, pick up a book and stop coming waiting on me to try to educate you over things that you are clearly choosing not to, to engage with. So there's a triggering, like, I am not here to educate you. Go learn, go pick up a book. Why must this constantly be creating these safe spaces for white people? This is again another form of this apartheid where we're giving them the upper hand. Like, damn it, we're tired. If you don't know it, then you'll see yourself. There's a level, there's a school of thought that believes, talks about triggering. We're triggered. I can't help when a person says gay people are evil to feel in my chest the fire. And it sometimes overflows me and I'm like, you know? You know, that's being triggered. And if you, and I'm like, and Kundalini yoga and meditation allows you to take control of your triggers, but not everyone's there. And so when I'm triggered, I can't, I'm not really responsible for you're triggering something in me and I blast. So really, are those spaces possible where we can just have candid conversation? Because you can be triggering people left, right, and center. So now there's this standpoint of how are we going to go about this, you know? Like, how do we move forward in our Sangat as
white? That's an interesting question to ask. So do you have any clues about that? So I have these conversations with my friends.
Yeah.
My family. I suppose you can, you know, trying to find a space where you can really say anything and allow yourself to be educated with all the commotion that we surround ourselves with. It's difficult, right? From just a communal point of view. But is there perhaps, and I don't want to call this solution because I appreciate the fact that people have their own journeys. But is there a way for us to find a solace in each other that is not connected to always fighting each other all the time?
Yeah, I'm so tired.
is there a way?
I'm not tired in terms of an energetic. I've got a lot of energy.
Yeah.
My journey, my spiritual journey, and the work that I do, my lifestyle gives me a lot of energy, but not for fighting. I don't want to fight anymore. I don't want to fight black people. I don't want to fight homophobic. I think in Kundalini yoga they say there's a diagonal line. So that's the line between standing up for what you believe in and enforcing it, but also compassion and having the spiritual wisdom of a healer, you know? That's the diagonal line. And it comes down to balance, I think. I think everyone needs to do their part. I am more likely to have a conversation. I've got a lot of white friends, very close. My past, my flatmates have been mixed or white or whatever. You know, I live with them. I've got family that are of different race, you know. And a lot of them, we have a lot of candid conversations that, you know, they wouldn't be able to ask those questions just in Jay in a forum at a workshop, that they'll ask me, and I'm able to sit down and even laugh and be like, okay, this is the guy I'm dating even, you know, we have a lot, he's white, and we have a lot of conversations about race, you know, and there's things that he says and I'm like, oh boy, you need to sit down. Let me break this down to you. No, I'm going to break it down to you, because they come to me, they're meeting me halfway. They've done the work. They've read books. They've involved themselves. They've gone in, and there's still those things. You know, when you're at school and you've the teachers, you're in the lecture, you've listened to the lecture, you've gone home, you've done them, and then there's assignment, and there's still that question you just don't understand. You're like, but you say this, and the book says this, but how is this so?
Mm.
Those are the people that I'm trying to engage with. The people who have done the work, done their part, and still have questions that might be absurd, that might even be basic. Sometimes you have basic questions, even if you've done a lot of work, that's what we're doing. But people who are just coming off the street to be like, well, you do all the work. You tell me what it is. In that self is violent. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So, and this is my personal thing. This is also another thing about everything. Like, I'm about to enroll in September to get my wellness coach certification. And I'm getting it at a school, and I'm in an American school in New York online, that I really appreciate, because I first thought I wanted to do Ayurveda practice. I want to be an Ayurvedic practitioner. So I'm really interested.
What's Ayurveda?
Ayurveda is an ancient Indian tradition, medicine tradition of healing,
okay,
using natural products. They understand...
So it's like Ubungoma, basically.
yes, in terms of context, yes,
okay.
But it was different in terms of practice, obviously.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have this idea. I mean, the main component is Ayurvedic medicine believes that we have doshas.
Mm.
We're different doshas. We are ruled by wind energy, earth energy, fire energy, ether energy.
So those are the doshas.
Those are the doshas. So it's
okay.
Kapha, which is earth, Vata, which is wind, Pitta, that is fire, and all of us are a combination of it,
of all of them. Yeah.
And the problem ailments that we find in society is a cause of an imbalance of those doshas.
Mm.
You want to be balanced Kapha, earth, balanced Pitta, fire, balanced Vata. So for me, I currently have an imbalance of Vata. I have way too much wind energy.
Mm.
And that manifests itself. Usually people who have wind energy are quite slender. They get cold quite easily. You know, cold quite easy, hands and feet. There we go. You know, that ideas, if you've got Vata mind, because there's also the difference between physical and mind. Vata mind, you know, you've got ideas, it's all of that. Pitta is they're more of the people who like doing. They're achievers, they're the managers, they're the coaches, you know what I mean? And an imbalance is that is burnout. Burnout.
Okay.
You know that.
Okay.
So there's a whole. That's a whole nother podcast. In itself.
Yeah.
But
I was actually going to ask, but yeah, continue.
No, go ahead.
No, because I remember, for instance, in Vipassana practice meditation, where you start feeling the different sensations based on the elements. Even
definitely,
the food that you eat.
Definitely.
And,
So as a Vata, because I've got a Vata imbalance, I need to avoid, but everything is earth, fire, in the world that you see. So also the food we eat. Vata food is like salads and, you know, uncooked raw stuff and all of that. And we tend to like that because it's light and I can keep going, but that's not what I should be eating.
Mm.
I should be eating food that grounds me. So the potatoes, the starches and everything, because I've got, and once my Vata is balanced, then I can start changing my diet in that way.
Mm.
A whole thing, there's a woman called Sarah Rose, who's I look up to in terms of Ayurveda. She's like the millennial voice, Deepak Chopra calls her, of Ayurveda and spirituality. And you can check, I love her podcast as well. You can check out, she's got a quiz where you can find out your doshas. I'll send you a link to that.
Cool. Sarah Rose. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll check out.
Yeah, she's okay. Great. So then you've got, I thought I wanted to be an Ayurveda practitioner. But then you need to, it's this idea again, ego and mind of limitations, that one size fits all situation. Like, Ayurveda might be great for millions of people, doesn't mean it's great for everyone.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Biodiversity is what the school is about. And it's understanding, you learn all the types of diets and healing techniques from Ayurveda to Atkinson to all the things that all the new age caveman, all of those things.
Mm.
Because what you really do is finding tailor-made situations for individuals,
for yourself,
for
yes,
people.
Yes.
And this is also the thing where we keep trying to solve society's
issues
with tailor-made, like everyone must just have a workshop and speak about it, or no, everyone, no, it depends
on the context.
Yeah, let's first engage, and I'll find out when I look at you, I'll be like, okay, so this person, this is how we're going to deal with this.
Mm.
This group of people, this is how we're going to... I think we should stop being so lazy and thinking that we're just going to do one thing.
And we've solved everyone's problems. But
we're all unique individuals that stem from
on different paths.
And on different paths.
And on different cycles of life.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the flexibility, if I want a doctor, when I go to a doctor, the gynecologist I'm looking for, I want her to understand medicine, you know, from a medical perspective, you know, Western medicine. I also want her to understand the natural medicine. and I get that they do exist, they're hard to find, but that's who I'm looking for.
I have an experience actually with a cousin of mine.
Yeah.
So when I was growing up, his mother used to plant all these herbs in the garden.
Mm.
And, you know, they were vegetarian in the ghetto.
Wow.
In the 80s.
Wow.
And the 90s.
That's revolutionary.
Not even, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, the natural step from their grandparents to their grandparents that they've recognized that they were not disconnected from. But obviously, you know, I'd go to their house, and I remember one day I was sick. I was really sick.
Mm.
I had a stomach ache. And she just went to the garden. She took some plants, put them in the pot, boiled. I had a cup full. Mm. 20 minutes later, completely gone, right? And my cousin then went on to become a doctor, like a GP. And he was telling me the story. He said, you know, one of his patients keeps coming back to him, the same problem.
Mm.
And eventually said to the patient, just eat well. Like, don't put bullshit into your body. And the patient was offended.
Mm.
They were just like, you're a doctor. You're supposed to be solving my problems, right? So don't be telling me to eat well.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of a doctor are you?
That's insane.
and you know, to him, obviously he grew up in that context where his mother directly taught him all these principles about nature and all of that. And he then said that he actually started to see the separation between what we term Western medicine and, you know, the traditional sort of ethos of medicine. And he's now interested in merging the two because they're actually not separate. Again, integration, right?
No, I mean, I get it. That's my mom. My mom is a psychologist.
Yes.
But she integrates psychology, Western psychology, with African traditional healing.
Because,
I mean, a lot of people think that a traditional healer, there are different types of traditional healer. You've got the ones who are more, you can attune to, who have more work on psychological issues.
Yes.
And they're ones who work with medicine and herbs.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So my mom is more with the ones with psychological, because those are the OG African therapists. When you go there, when you got troubles in your marriage, when you think someone has possessed you, you go to them, you know?
Mm.
And my mom really did her PhD on understanding how to integrate those two forces and working in university, African universities, with students from different diverse backgrounds who come and say, I'm failing because there's a person in my village who's jealous that I made it this far, and my mom was telling me that they're doing a curse on me. What am I supposed to do? Now, a Western psychologist is like, you know? But if you've integrated traditional healing and understand, my mom tells of a story of someone who had integrated the two. And the lady comes, and she was from a polygamous relationship. Mm-hmm. She was a third wife, and she was not getting along with the first wife, and they were fighting, and she felt that the first wife was really like terrible and and was, you know, it was horrendous. So she was like, you know what, I know, I'm gonna go to the traditional healer, because that's the only way I'm gonna handle this person.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to the doctor, the traditional healer, and goes, listen, this is her, she's on my case, she's done this, she says, there's fire, it's explosiveness every time we're in a room. People have now decided to separate us. Please, can you help me? Give me the medicine I need to put this woman in her place. You know? Integrated doctor goes, okay. He doesn't go, no, let's think of the trauma that deals with you. You need to speak the language that the person is speaking, right?
Mm.
So he goes, okay. Goes, and I'm going to make something for you. Goes, takes a sponge, dips it in some oils, adds some herbs, blah, 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 ties it, puts a sweet scent to it, ties it there and puts it, gives it to her and says, whenever you're in a room with this woman, as soon as she starts her nonsense and, you know, take this medicine,
put it in your mouth and bite on hard to it till the juices flow, and just slowly let it go down your throat.
Mm.
Okay, great. She's like, great, you know, like, I'm gonna do that. She gets there, you know, goes. Obviously, then one of the family, the wife starts, she goes in her bag, puts it in her tooth, chows onto it, feels the sweet scents, the oils, the lady's going on, she just holds on. He says, do not let go. Keep holding on, clenching onto that. Continues doing this for about a month. Comes back to the doctor and goes, you will not believe what happened. She is completely a different person. She says hello to me when she enters. She asks me if I want food. She da-da-da-da. It's amazing. This medicine's great. I need more of it. Western medicine. Obviously, the reason from a Western perspective that this relationship is better is because this woman is no longer reacting.
Mm, exactly.
While the woman is out there
doing
her thing.
I was thinking that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. While the woman is busy doing her thing, she's focusing on clenching her teeth. And now, so basically, this woman is just fighting herself.
Mm.
And obviously, she, as time goes on, the anger starts to subside. And instead of saying, the fuck do you want in here, my language, she goes, do you want some food? And the relationship literally starts to change,
yes.
You know? And so that's how my mom, when she's now like dealing with the students and, you know, the schools, and she wants to integrate the both and be like, okay, let's not pretend that doesn't exist and be like, no, that's nonsense, there's no such thing as witchcraft.
Mm.
Be like, okay. So what herbs are they using? Okay, all right, okay. So we're going to handle that, but also implement the psychological aspect and tie that in and creating unique, tailor-made things. And it was great.
Mm.
And that's also the thing that I use with the way I teach a yoga class in Hillbrow, to the way I teach a yoga class in Morningside, to the way I teach a yoga is very different.
Mm.
It's depending on who my people are, the language I use, the mannerism I use, the context, and I think, stop being lazy. One size doesn't fit all. People are like, oh, but I don't know, I must change every time. What's wrong with that? What are you losing?
Because at the end of the day, you're finding the context, and you're using the parameters of that context to teach.
Exactly.
And that's
exactly.
How people learn. Cool, I think.
Yeah, we could go on forever. I was like, maybe we should get food, let's chill.